This is Thoughts from a Useless Eater. Welcome back. And I'm JQ Useless. You can visit our website and download all of our podcasts at uselesseatersinstitute.wordpress.com. And you can contact the show at any time at jqueless@aol.com. And today we're picking up again with the ongoing and indefinite series called When the World Stopped Making Sense, and this is part three of When the World Stopped Making Sense. And when we left off in part two of this series, we were looking at a construct that I like to call material middle class fake rationality. It's kind of a matrix of an epistemological matrix or a belief matrix or a sociocultural matrix, whatever you choose to call it, or a construct that kind of defines the mindset that so many of us who are part of the so-called middle class in the United States grew up as taking as basically our reality, our defining set of principles that determined how we look at the world. And just as sort of a schema to give some structure to how we would break down and analyze and discuss characteristics of that matrix or construct, we were starting our way through 10 characteristics, with 10 being just an arbitrary number of characteristics to examine in our breakdown of material middle class fake rationality. So after a long introduction, we got through the first two characteristics, and if you missed part two of, if you missed When the World Stopped Making Sense number two, I would advise you to go back and give that a listen so that this current discussion will make sense to you, because in the interest of time, we're just going to not recap any of the introduction or our look at the first two characteristics, but we're just going to proceed right into characteristic number three. And number three is, the advances of medical science and technology, like vaccines, for example, are meant to help you lead a longer, healthier life. Doctors and medical researchers, medical scientists care about you. If you're sick, they want you to get better. So do you believe that today? I don't believe that today, and I really think most people, whether or not they subscribe to so-called conspiracy theories about medicine, probably don't uncritically believe that about the medical profession today. I think in some ways it's almost a cliche to be a little bit skeptical, even if you don't fully understand some of the very good underlying reasons to be skeptical. But let me take a look at it from two different angles. One is sort of a personal experience type of angle. Early in my life, I would say, you know, relatively early in my life, and perhaps put the word early a little bit in quotation marks, from the time I was born until the time I was maybe, you know, 18, 19 years old, I went to pretty old school doctors. My pediatrician during that period of my life probably went to medical school in the 1930s or 1940s at the latest. So she had a very old-school approach. But I think even more so, the family doctor that my parents and my older brothers and sisters went to during the time that I was going to the pediatrician was quite old-school as well. Born at this about the same year my dad was, I guess, in early 1920s, maybe exactly the same year, maybe 1922. And again, which would have put him in medical school somewhere in the 1940s, I guess, possibly after World War II, because he was part of that generation. And he was someone who, I even remember him making house calls, for instance, during an incident when my dad had pulmonary embolisms that started as blood clots in his legs. I remember him coming to the house. Probably on more than one occasion I remember him coming to the house. So I suppose that in the mid to late 1960s, even at that time, that was a fairly old school thing to be doing, but not long after that, it was pretty much unheard of. But more than that, his approach to practicing medicine wasn't as oriented towards giving medicine as things are today. Today, physicians seem to be really quick to get out the prescription pad, and although in the alternative media world, it may seem like a bit of a cliche to say that medicine today is not about wellness or about cures, but about disease management to keep people on these medications under more of a subscription pricing model. Because a prescription is a lot like a subscription in the sense that it's recurring revenue. So if someone needs a medication for life, and as expensive as medications are today, that's an awful lot of revenue for a drug company over a period of years, and the need to manage that, that's an awful lot of recurring visits, wellness checkups or med checks for a physician over the lifetime of a patient. Things just seemed to, when the old man passed away that was our traditional family doctor for so many years, that's when I seemed to notice a change in medicine. Certainly, that was around the ascendancy of the rise of the whole managed care and HMO paradigm. I think everybody felt the changes then. But again, it was a more different approach. And I think medications at that time were even different. People today are pretty quick to say that, you know, all medications are evil, all vaccines are evil, etc., etc., etc. I don't really want to get into the vaccine topic at this point because there's so much to discuss on that topic alone, and I'm coming at things from a bigger picture perspective at this point. But I think that there were, at the time I was a child, maybe from the time I was a child to around the time that, you know, the early 1980s or late 70s, early 80s, there wasn't as much as this ramrodding through of FDA approvals. There didn't seem to be as much of really questionable side effects of a lot of medications that you see today. But let's step back and look at it from a more general point of view in terms of how medicine changed over the course of the 20th century. There was a time when there were many different kinds of doctors competing for the healthcare consumer earlier in United States history. There were chiropractors, there were homeopathic doctors, there were holistic practitioners, and there were allopathic physicians, and those are the ones who are oriented more towards diagnosing conditions and treating them with medications, and not paying so much attention to things like lifestyle and nutrition and things of that sort. Now, oh, and I didn't mention osteopathic physicians either, who, you know, after a period of struggling a lot to maintain their credibility and place in the medical community, finally have managed to get themselves to be almost on an equal footing with allopathic physicians. But what happened? What made it so that MDs, allopathic physicians, came to dominate the medical profession starting in the 20th century. Well, some people say, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, that it dates from the issuance of a study called the Flexner Report by Abraham Flexner, which was sponsored apparently by the Carnegie Foundation, although some people who look at this document want very much to bring the Rockefellers into it as well. And I don't really know enough yet to have an opinion on the subject one way or another. Actually, the Flexner Report is available, I believe, on archive.org in full text. I have downloaded. I have started to read it. But I have some background understanding of the document and the study behind it and its purpose through other sources that I will go into shortly. But let me just read an excerpt of a retrospective of the Flexner Report, which was published in 2011. I'm sorry, the Flexner Report was originally published in 1910. And the Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine in 2011 published a study that was published an article that was written in 2010 by Thomas P. Duffy, MD, who seems to take a fairly, at least based on the abstract that I'm going to read, take a fairly balanced perspective on the Flexner Report and what it did to medicine. I'll just say that in brief, before I go into Dr. Duffy's perspective, that the Flexner Report was a report on the study that was pretty much responsible for changing and standardizing medicine in the United States to a point where allopathic medicine became almost everything. And again, for a period, chiropractors and osteopaths and everybody else truly were out of the picture, although those two approaches, to a greater extent than holistic and homeopathic practice, have come to be more accepted by the mainstream, especially osteopathic medicine, which again, as I mentioned before, is pretty much on an equal footing today with allopathic medicine. But here's Dr. Duffy's abstract. The Flexner Report of 1910 transformed the nature and process of medical education in America with the resulting elimination of proprietary schools and the establishment of the biomedical model as the gold standard of medical training. This transformation occurred in the aftermath of the report, which embraced scientific knowledge and its advancement as the defining ethos of a modern physician. Such an orientation had its origins in the enchantment with German medical education, and I'll repeat that because that could be significant, the enchantment with German medical education that was spurred by the exposure of American educators and physicians at the turn of the century to the university medical schools of Europe. American medicine profited immeasurably from the scientific advances that this system allowed, but the hyper-rational system of German science created an imbalance in the art and science of medicine. A catching up is underway to realign the professional commitment of the physician with a revision of medical education to achieve that purpose. I'd say that's possibly an overly optimistic point of view, that a catching up is underway. We'll have to see what happens as this country shifts into something that looks more like a nationalized medical model, even though initially with the Affordable Care Act, we're ostensibly not yet going into a nationalized model, but there are certainly elements that very much resemble elements of, say, the National Health Service over in the UK. But that's an interesting perspective on the Flexner Report to have been published, especially in a mainstream journal which comes from Yale University of all places, and I'm kind of glad to see that. But there are others, granted from much less mainstream and less well-known sources, that take a very different view of the Flexner Report and what it did, and look at it as something that was more overtly or more monolithically sinister in nature. Now, those of us who are old enough to notice that the older doctors were different, including doctors who, including many who went to medical school after the date of the Flexner Report, which again was in 1910, well, you have to realize a couple of things. That the full effects of implementing the dominance of the principles that emerged from the Flexner Report of how medicine should be taught and practiced obviously would have taken a number of years, even decades, to fully work their way through the medical education and medical practice system. And the second thing to keep in mind is that it's not as if MD programs and the allopathic approach to medicine were anything new when the Flexner Report came out. This was an existing mode of medical practice and medical education in the United States. It's simply the one that came to dominate. I'm not sure why. I need to obviously do more research into the history here, but it came to dominate perhaps because it was already the most quote-unquote scientific compared to the alternatives that were in existence: osteopathy, chiropractic, holistic medicine, homeopathic medicine, etc. But the point is that even the MDs who were of, say, the World War II generation and older were different in their orientation, and that's why some of us remember in our younger years doctors being more conservative and not just being ready to throw a medication at something or throw surgery at something at the drop of the hat the way they so often are today. And of course, pharmacology and surgery are the big money makers today. And chances are, if you have a chronic condition of some sort, the approach to your treatment will be managing your illness through medication until you need surgery. You're going to end up in one of those scenarios, the way medicine is practiced today. Now, in the medical community, at the time the Flexner Report was issued, there was opposition. I would have to explore again a little bit more deeply to know a great deal about who the key figures in that opposition were. But there's one person who I've been aware of for some time who was part of that opposition. How well known or influential he was at that time, I don't know. But his name is Emanuel M. Josephson, and he was a New York City physician. He was an MD, an allopath, but he was an older allopath because he was active in terms of some of the books he published that were critical of the medical system, the political system, and so on, from probably the 1940s through the late 1960s. Among his other books are, the first book of his that I ever came across back in the late 1980s was Rockefeller Internationalist, which I believe was published in the 1950s. But from a medical standpoint, he was a critic, apparently, of what he thought of as the Rockefeller approach to medicine. And the book that he published on that subject is called Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine. I don't have that book. I haven't read it yet. It's very expensive to find in print. I've recently found out that there may be an ebook available somewhere, but I haven't attempted to download it yet. But again, the title, Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine, and here is the summary from Amazon, where a 1948 hardcover is, well, apparently there are new, used and new copies available, starting at $51.70. But here's the summary on the Amazon entry. Apparently, no, this is a customer review by Carmi B. Hazen, who is an energy medicine journalist. This looks interesting. Let me see here. Carmi B. Hazen, who describes, I don't even know, I guess that's a man's name, who describes himself as an energy medicine journalist and amateur researcher, who wrote a review on Amazon of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Emmanuel M. Josephson. So here's the review. Dr. Josephson was a truth seeker and an anti-establishment physician. John D. Rockefeller began a takeover of the medical establishment using the Flexner Report of 1910 as a guideline to take control of the medical schools to push profitable pharmaceuticals made mostly from petroleum bases. Now that's something I didn't know about. How many people know that? It's something I would definitely want to vet before accepting it as gospel truth, but it's an intriguing notion, particularly considering the Rockefeller tie-in and considering some other very questionable food and drug products that are indeed made from petroleum bases. So, and again, this summary here also kind of puts together the tie-in between Flexner and Rockefeller. So if the Flexner Report was funded by the Carnegie Foundation, Rockefeller apparently, at least according to this point of view, latched onto it opportunistically as something that he could use to profit from and benefit from, to transform medicine in a way that would be personally beneficial to him and others involved in the industries, other allies in the industries that make him, that made him such a rich man. So anyway, I'll go on here. Numerous physicians were appalled that the time-honored practice of medicine had been taken over by organized crime with the money moguls at the controls. Again, those are the robber barons who some would say are one in the same with at least one incarnation or manifestation of organized crime, the organized crime model. Dr. Josephson fought them by writing this awesome book, which ultimately cost him his life. And that's something I didn't know about Josephson either. I've made some sputtering attempts to do some research on Josephson. I would especially like the opportunity to interview any living descendant of his who would be willing to talk. I think that would be most intriguing to get a perspective. But, you know, when I first encountered Josephson's work, I kind of poo-pooed him as a paranoid crackpot conspiracy theorist. But now, in concert with many other things that have made my point of view in general on things of that ilk change, I don't dismiss his work as at all, and it seems quite conceivable to me that as a fairly well-connected professionally and socially New York City physician, he would have probably been in a pretty good position to know what the real deal was concerning Rockefeller and some of the other robber barons, and in turn to understand how their activities would apply in the medical realm as well as the political realm. Again, Josephson wrote extensively on politics, and he's arguably one of the seminal authors of the whole American conspiracy movement, so to speak. So I'll go on with the review here. Many cures and effective treatments were deliberately suppressed so that the maximum revenue could be extorted from suffering patients who placed their faith in physicians who were functionally uneducated and were forced by rules and regulations to provide near worthless treatments that maximize profits. Now again, you know, why would the doctors go along with this? Because they profited from it too. A big part of the effect, if not the intent, of the Flexner Report was to create a scarcity within the medical profession and to make doctors much more highly compensated professionals than they were before. So again, if there is a questionable Rockefeller agenda, quote unquote, well, what gets the doctors to buy into it and support it? Well, again, it's the same motivation in both cases, the almighty dollar. So continuing with the review, this is the situation we find ourselves in the millennium. As little has changed since Josephson first published this work in 1948. Ask your doctor as to how it is possible to poison people back to health. I don't think, for some reason, I don't think you would get a very good result. Most people would get a very good result if they asked their doctor how it is possible to poison people back to health. You would probably either get a best case scenario, you'd get a deer in the headlights look. Worst case scenario, well, you can imagine maybe a referral to mandatory psychiatric care, or at least a notation on your permanent record, your permanent electronic health record, that may at some point in your life, in your future life, come back to haunt you. So I don't recommend asking that question to your doctor, but this reviewer of Dr. Josephson's book does. So Dr. Josephson herein provides an effective treatment protocol that reverses all symptomology of muscular dystrophy in the majority of cases that follow the simple dietary and vitamin regimen he developed that pulled many children out of wheelchairs and gave them normal lives. This work is a classic and remains timely even after 63 years of gathering dust on the shelf. Caveat emptor. Carmi Hazen, again, the author of this customer review on Amazon. So if you can get hold of that book, I suggest reading it. I plan to as well. Again, I have not read it yet, but I have read others of Dr. Josephson's work, and he's someone that I've wanted for a long time to research much more deeply, and intend to soon, and I will certainly report any results of that on this show. One thing I do know that I did uncover from this research is that he was very active in the anti-fluoridation movement. And in fact, there was an article that Ale Eric and Theodoric on the Alembic Files recently mentioned in the course of discussion of another of Josephson's books, which was The Strange Death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But Al mentioned that he remembered running across a full-page newspaper ad that an organization in New York had taken out featuring a number of doctors urging, I guess it was, I don't know if it was New York City or the state or what municipal entity it was, but urging not to allow fluoridation of the water supply. And I also back in the late 80s ran across a similar full-page advertisement featuring a number of those doctors, picturing a number of them even, including Dr. Josephson, speaking out against fluoridation. I think there was even an organization that Josephson was involved with called the Anti-Fluoridation League back in the 50s. And again, that's another subject of research. I would love to see others research this background, and would invite anyone who has done or intends to do or has any background knowledge on this topic, specifically pertaining to Dr. Josephson's role, to contact me at jqueless@aol.com to see about possibly appearing with me here on the show. So there you have it in terms of critiques of characteristic number 3 of our matrix from two different perspectives. You can see it from personal experience if you're old enough to remember that doctors somehow just seem to approach things differently in terms of their approach to illness and treatment. From that personal standpoint, you can at least appreciate the idea that something, to some degree, is at least amiss. Or if you look at this narrative with the Flexner Report and Josephson's critique of it as pointing to something possibly nefarious underlining the change in medicine that we saw over the course of the 20th century as another angle to look at it from. Either way, number 3 is compellingly exposed as at best a myth. So we'll move on here to characteristic number 4, which you could say is related to the above with regard to medicine. And that's that the dangers of the world can be overcome through science and technology. And that's a pretty simple and straightforward one. And I think the medical paradigm is a good way to approach any critique of this idea, because I think there was a time that we became really almost intoxicated with the capabilities of medicine and science when supposedly through... let me back up a little bit and give you a personal account that I think is illustrative of the both the idea that this is true, that science and technology can overcome the dangers of this world, and of the fallacies of the point of view as well. My grandfather, who was born, I guess, in the 1880s, that makes me sound a lot older than I am, because my grandfather married quite late in his life, and my grandmother, and this is on my mother's side, was also around the same age that he was, and so they married and had children quite late in their lives. So their children, most of the parents of children of my mother's generation, were about 10 or 15 years at least younger than her parents were. So anyway, leaving that aspect of it aside, my grandfather was stricken with polio as a relatively young man. I guess it happened when my mother was quite young. And no, he didn't end up being paralyzed from the waist down, but he had very weak legs, I guess. He wasn't wheelchair bound or anything like that. But was very restricted in the use of his legs, and one of the things, he was an engineer, and he worked in the automotive industry and various, you know, appliance sorts of industries that were operated by some of the same corporate entities that operated the automotive companies at the time during the Great Depression. But one of the things he always said to my mother and her brother was that, you know, thank God I learned to make a living using my head, because if I had been dependent for my livelihood on my body, I would have been in an awful lot of trouble. So he had polio, he had very bad effects from it. So, as one might imagine, my mother was quite enamored with what vaccines were supposedly able to do in eradicating diseases like polio. And similarly, there was great fear at the time of her childhood in the 1920s and 30s, especially living in a city. I guess this wasn't as interestingly, this wasn't something that my father talked about as much with regard to his childhood. He was 2 years older than my mother, but living in a city, there was considerable fear of tuberculosis when the news reports were out on major outbreaks of tuberculosis from time to time. There was a real fear and a real hesitance to go out. You know, there was all this concern about people spitting on the street who might, you know, spread the disease. So, if I recall correctly, the story was from my mother that there were times that her mother did not let her go out at all. You know, she wasn't allowed to go out to the movies and so forth when there was a major outbreak of tuberculosis known to be taking place. You know, whether my grandmother overreacted or not, or was overprotective, who knows? But the point is, there was great fear of tuberculosis. And again, that was something that she very much credited modern medicine and modern medications for making that a disease that was close to unheard of by maybe the time that my mother herself began having children. Mostly in the 1950s, and then myself overlapping into the 60s. So antibiotics and vaccines, allergy serums were wonders to her, wonder drugs, the wonders of medical science that made our quality of life so much better, so that our life expectancies could go up, and so that our lives didn't have to be short, brutish, and dark, which was a phrase that she was fond of using. And I think that's a phrase that's more associated with medieval times, but in a lot of ways you could argue that it is a phrase that applied to the time of her grandparents and even parents as well, because I mean, my grandmother, her mother, to give an example, was one of perhaps 12 siblings that her parents had, my great-grandparents had. And again, these were folks who were born even further back in the 1860s, so probably born a bit before the Civil War. And the scenario with their children was quite typical at that time, as far as I know. They had about 12 siblings, and maybe 8 or so survived. Or I should say, my great-grandparents had about 12 children, of whom 8 or so survived, and about 4 died in childhood. And I think there was even a time, maybe this was even further back, but when the majority of people who were born ended up died in childhood, and that's why people had so many children, because surviving childhood was a much more iffy thing. I guess if you, and I think that was, of course, a big part of, you know, the outlier, that was the outlier that pushed life expectancies so far down, was probably infant mortality, because I think for those who did make it out of childhood successfully, I think, you know, living to a ripe old age was a not uncommon scenario. But the point is that a time when these medical wonders were not available, medical and scientific and technological wonders were not available, was not very far recessed in the sort of collective consciousness that my mother, you know, inherited from her forebears. So, growing up from a time when these medical wonders were not, by and large, present, to a time when it seemed like all these dire diseases, you know, smallpox, polio, tuberculosis, were leprosy, were all but eradicated, was something that could people could become almost enamored and worshipful of, and really put their faith in. But if we look at history, how long did any of that really last? I'd say that by some, we're looking at, you know, the 1950s is probably the peak of when the vaccines and the so-called wonder drugs and the antibiotics and all that really were at their peak of producing in society almost a hubris that we would be able to conquer all these dangerous diseases and increase human life expectancy and just enjoy a much better quality of life and reduce infant mortality. And again, in many cases, you know, it's still true today. It's not very common that you hear of people dying of influenza. Or I remember when I read Pride and Prejudice for the first time, the main character's father was about 47 years old, and he was telling his daughter, you know, someday before too long, I am going to catch a common cold. I will not get better from it. People died in those days from the common cold. And that's not very, that way of life is not all that far removed. You know, the Victorian years is not all that far removed from the time of my great-grandparents. So certainly that would form a backdrop against which to comparatively assess the medical and scientific wonders of the 20th century, which were probably at their peak in some ways in the 1950s and 1960s in terms of confidence and what they would be able to accomplish for humanity at that time. But my memories by, say, the 1970s were present about discovering the limitations of all these wonders, like antibiotics and vaccines. I remember hearing my mother talk about how, you know, tuberculosis was starting to come back, which it was. Or how there were even some remaining leprosy cases in Louisiana, I think she said. And the problems of the drug-resistant strains of bacterial infections that came as the result, possibly, of the use of antibiotics or the overuse of antibiotics. I mean, that was at the forefront of very much of an issue and a concern, probably by the early to mid-1980s at the latest. There was a big awareness of that these drugs were losing their effectiveness and weren't so wonderful. And then even worse, we've all collectively witnessed things like drugs being ramrodded through the approval process only to have deadly side effects show up. We find that these chemicals that were supposed to be saving lives are actually killing people in some cases. And there's good reason to believe that what we know about may be just scratching the surface. So I think, in many ways, those of us who are aware and sensible and who are able to exercise some degree of, at least, of critical thinking, are much more skeptical of the wonders of science and technology. Even though technology is advancing at a rapid pace and that there's always talk about extending the human lifespan and stopping the aging process through various kinds of interventions, genetic engineering, whatever, I think we're aware that there is often a side effect of a drug or an unintended consequence of any kind of scientific or medical procedure that could in some way benefit our health. There's always a flip side. So there was a brief window during which many of us uncritically believed all these things that are kind of summed up in characteristic number 4. But today, not so much. There's a certain degree of sobriety and disillusionment about our limitations of science to the limitations on the ability of science to improve our quality of life in the long run. And maybe that's a healthy thing in some ways. We may be arriving at a better and more healthy understanding of the fact that our mortality is a real thing, no matter how much we exercise our ability to make tools and manipulate the environment and exploit the properties of certain chemicals and compounds that occur either naturally or that can be synthesized in the laboratory to overcome human problems. There is always a pitfall. And just look at our other aspects of modernity. What effect has industrialization and the use of fossil fuels and mass transportation widely available personal transportation available to the common man, what have the unintended consequences of that been, regardless of whether you buy into the global warming paradigm? There's always a negative side, and you could look at that as evidence of the fact that man and this world will always be limited because this is a sin-fallen world. Or that there will always be a deceptiveness behind the seeming amazing things that we're capable of developing because, as we learn in Matthew 4 so clearly, that this world right now, because of man's sin, is temporarily under the control of the dark side, under control of Satan. So for every disease we cure, there's a new one down the pike. Whether or not you posit that there's some sinister depopulation agenda at work, or that toxins are being sprayed upon us by chemtrails, by the planes making the crisscrossing chemtrails as they fly overhead. Regardless as to whether you attribute it to human volition, for every 2 steps forward, there may be at least 1 step back. And that's a reality of the human condition that helps us to realize that we shall not be as gods, no matter what we do, no matter how far we go. There are always vulnerabilities. Honeybees are dying. Is that a result of Monsanto's GMO foods? Or is it something else that we're doing to the environment that's causing that to happen? We don't know. We're not omniscient, and we're not always able to anticipate unintended consequences and side effects of our scientific advances. So we should realize that we're still mortals. We're still limited. We're not gods, and we never will be. Are there some people who don't believe that, who believe that we can become gods? Yes, very definitely. And perhaps those are the most dangerous ones of all. Are there elitists who truly believe that the scientific and technological capabilities of man can overcome human problems? Maybe. But there's strong reason to believe that they don't want to make that available to everyone. You hear people like Alex Jones and others of that ilk saying, look at the longevity of these people. Look at David Rockefeller. Look at the longevity of elites in entertainment circles in some cases. What's keeping Mick Jagger and Keith Richards so youthful and seemingly energetic, even though they've led lifestyles that probably would have torn anyone else to smithereens years and years ago? We don't know. Maybe there are some in this world who have access to an even greater level of scientific capabilities and medical capabilities that most of us don't even know about. I don't have an opinion on those kinds of theories necessarily one way or another, but I think that even for them, maybe especially for them, they will eventually run into those limitations. And nobody has become immortal yet. Nobody's been able to unfreeze their head and be reconstituted. No one except the Lord Jesus Christ has been able to return from the dead since the ascension of Christ. There were others, of course, in the Bible who were resurrected, some by Christ himself, like Lazarus. But we don't have any reason to believe that somebody like a David Rockefeller or a Mick Jagger will eventually depart this mortal coil. Look at Steve Jobs, all of his billions, all of his riches. Couldn't save him from pancreatic cancer. So even for the most among us, there are limitations. And so those of us, the least among us, the useless eaters, do especially well to be cognizant of that, and to put their faith not in medical science, not in technology, but in the Lord God, who tells us in his word that his son, our Lord Jesus Christ, will return to earth again and will make things all right, will make all wrongs right, and will overcome the evil that was begun in the Garden of Eden, who will destroy the wicked and return man to the state that the Lord intended him to live in. God brought his son, who we're told existed from the beginning of time, from before the beginning, from before the creation and had him become a man. And his word tells us that he is still existing as a man, as a God-man with a glorified body, but as a man nonetheless. What does that tell you about what man was intended to be? And that is our hope, our blessed hope, as Paul says, that we will one day return, those of us who have faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, will return to that original state. But through God's grace and God's glory and God's capabilities, and not through any of these spurious and ephemeral and limited and mixed and deceptive scientific and technological advances of man. And that brings us pretty close to the end of our time here with our look at characteristic number 4. So we're working our way through the list. This gives us a good stopping point. And we will pick it up again in the next segment of When the World Stopped Making Sense, which may not be the next episode of this podcast, because again, this is going to be an occasional recurring series. But we will pick it up soon and continue until we work our way through this list of 10 characteristics of material, middle-class, fake rationality, the mindset that I inherited, that I was born into, the mindset that many of you probably bought into for much of your life. But if you're like even most people who don't investigate the kinds of things that we look at on this podcast, most of you, most people to some extent or another, have become aware of the limitations of this mindset. So until we meet again on our next podcast, thank you for listening. As always, feedback is welcome at jqueusless@aol.com, and please visit our website at Useless Eaters Institute, all one word, at wordpress.com for the ongoing updates to this podcast and for blog entries on topics that we might not deal with on the podcast. And in the meantime, God bless, and we'll speak to you soon.